This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio EcoShock. I am your tour guide, Alex Smith. In this week's program, we travel the world. From New Zealand, we'll hash out our disturbed weather with the co-host of The Climate Show, Gareth Renouden. Then it's off to Beijing, straight to China. Greenpeace Asia campaigner Li Yan is our guest. We'll cap that off with Tip of the Iceberg News, my welcome back roundup of world-shaking developments, pointers to great audio, blogs, and articles, and four big trends in the alternative activist scene. Our music artist this week is Deva Premal. Find her at White Swan Records or devapremalmitten.com. All links mentioned in this program are also in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for joining us. Let's get to our guest. Coming back from my annual vacation, I find the world as mad as ever. So much happened, I need help just trying to grasp it all. And who better than Gareth Renouden, co-host of The Climate Show out of New Zealand. Gareth is a truffle specialist. He's a farmer, he's a radio personality, and now he's author of a new sci-fi book titled The Aviator, The Burning World. Gareth Renouden, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. It's a great pleasure.
Well, you know, it's been winter down under where you are, so I hope you've been paying attention to some of the important climate news. What do you think is the top story?
Well, I think without any question, it's definitely the Arctic sea ice. That is top story. It's the top of the world. It's melting, and the records are tumbling up there. So definitely the top story. From my perspective, it's a big and a visible sign of warming. And it has very immediate effects, I think, for the Northern Hemisphere.
Right. Well, I agree. And we're going to do a whole program next week on that meltback in the Arctic. And we've got some super specialists like Jennifer Francis, who talks about how that Arctic sea ice melt could be affecting weather throughout the whole Northern Hemisphere. And we've also got Mark Cerise. He's the expert from the National Snow and Ice Data Center. So he's going to talk to us a bit about those records. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I absolutely look forward to hearing what Jennifer Francis has to say, because her work has been really at the forefront of tying in the effect of the melt in the Arctic to changing weather patterns in the Northern Hemisphere.
And it has been bizarre here. In the East, there was hardly any winter. Summer started in March for many people, and it burned its way into a huge drought in the Midwest, just now sort of ending with the hurricane. And Britain practically drowned in rain at the same time. Does any of this make the news in New Zealand, or does each hemisphere just stare at their own strange weather?
Oh, I think, yeah, we do hear from the Northern Hemisphere quite a lot. I mean, we're not so insular as to sit out here and just stare at our own navels. But the difficulty with these events is that they get reported as, you know, it's news that there's flooding in Britain, or there's corn dying in the fields in the Midwest of the U.S., or that, you know, that it's been incredibly warm somewhere. Those things get reported, but what you don't get, I think, is sufficient of the big picture. People actually being prepared to say, well, look, these are all signs of what's happening to our climate system. And if you don't get that big picture, I mean, it's just another heat wave. Yeah, okay, so maybe a few records were set, but, you know, that happens all the time. But when you get heat wave and strange weather and sticky weather, which is what Jennifer Francis's work is all about, you have to look at more than just my backyard. You know, you have to be looking across the globe, seeing it all happening and saying, well, hey, look, the big picture here is that there's a lot of weird weather, and that weird weather is along the lines that people have been telling us is likely to happen with climate change, and hey, it's happening now.
Yeah, well, both the IPCC and James Hansen have said that this couldn't be happening without that extra emissions in the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that the attribution of these events to climate change, it is difficult to have a kind of 100% attribution of any given weather event to climate change. But Hansen's recent work makes a very convincing argument for being able to say that all of the heat waves that we're experiencing now are at least in some part a result of the climate change that's taken place in the last 30, 40 years. And I think that what's different, though, is that, and this is where the Arctic comes into it, what's happening up there with the melt of the ice means that when the ice refreezes in winter, an enormous amount of heat has to be lost from the surface of the ocean, and that goes into the atmosphere, and that has an effect. It has to have an effect. It's not something that can just be ignored or is only a small factor. It's actually an enormous factor in the circulation of the Northern Hemisphere. And I think what's taken a lot of people surprise, if you talk to the Arctic ice scientists, they're all surprised that the ice is going as quickly as it seems to be. And I think if you talk to the people who are looking at the effects of that melt on the atmosphere, they're surprised at how the sorts of effects that we're seeing in relation to the Arctic ice melt are happening. I mean, this is all stuff that if you go back to the last IPCC report in 2007, they're talking about, maybe by the end of the century we'll be losing the sea ice. And so nobody has really thought terribly hard, I think, anyway, at least until the last few years. What does this mean for our climate system now?
And another strange thing is that it's possible that if you get all that heat released and strange domes building up in the winter, next winter, here in the Northern Hemisphere, that you could drive some colder weather down into Siberia and down into Northern Europe. So it is possible you could go from an extreme of heat waves in the summertime to a really cold winter one winter, and that all could be part of this Arctic melt.
Well, that's absolutely right. And if you look at what's happened in Western Europe in the last few winters, they've had some really quite severe cold spells. The sort of cold spell that might have come along every 20 years, 30 or 40 years ago, now seem to be happening every 2 or 3 years or even more frequently. And that seems to be directly tied to the changes in the atmospheric circulation around the pole, now which is in turn related to the accumulation of heat up there, which is melting all the ice. So, it all kind of ties together, but it's like we don't have a roadmap for this because, and this is one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I haven't written about it yet, but I'm sort of working myself up to it. We look at the graphs that you see in IPCC reports, and you look at the graphs of what the sea ice is projected to do over the next 100 years. And what you're looking at generally is a nice smooth line. It's either going up or it's going down, but it looks like a smooth line. And what that smooth line, those smooth lines usually are the averages of lots of individual model runs. Now, if you look at the data that the individual model runs, they're very noisy. They jump up and down. They don't look like nice smooth lines. They don't look like pretty graphs, if you like. And it's maybe not so easy to see what's going on. But our Earth, the climate system, is only one model. And so what happens in reality is noisy. The lines go up and down a lot. And I think if we really want to get an understanding of what's going to happen to our climate system over the next 20 to 30 years as the Arctic ice disappears, we're going to have to start looking at individual model runs that are related to what we're seeing now. So maybe we've got to go and dig into the model runs that are maybe they're set 30 or 40 years in the future, but if they have similar ice conditions to now, well, what's happening in those models to the circulation of the atmosphere around the Northern Hemisphere? We're going to have to start diving down into the detail to try and pick out what's happening in the sort of nitty-gritty of where we live,
Well, the fact is we're in uncharted territory. Scientists are just as surprised as the rest of us at what's happening, so I guess we're going to have to watch and wait to a certain degree. And, you know, another underreported story that just fascinates me is the serial drowning of major cities in Asia by extreme precipitation events. We had one in the Philippines and the Manila this summer. They suffered a terrible flood. And then Beijing, China, got 6 months of rain in 24 hours. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I think there's a New Zealand scientist called Kevin Trenberth, who's really a very prominent climate scientist working at NCAR, in the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. And Kevin is one of the world's leading climate scientists. And the way that he puts it is that, you know, we've had warming over the last 30 to 40 years, and a warmer atmosphere holds more water. And so you've got more water available for precipitation. But what you're seeing in the tropical areas particularly is you're seeing very high sea surface temperatures. So you're getting a lot of water being evaporated off the surface of the ocean. The atmosphere moves it over the land, and so you get very intense rainfall. And I mean, that's one of the most robust predictions of the climate models have made in the last 20 or 30 years, that associated with warming, you're going to see more intense rainfall. And you can actually see it in the figures. The IPCC's report on extremes of weather, which came out late last year or earlier this year, I can't remember, the SREX, that suggested that, you know, we could see signs of climate change and warming in extreme rainfall. But yes, you're right. We're seeing these incredible deluges. And they're not. It's not just in tropical regions. Europe has had some astonishingly heavy rain. Last autumn in Europe, there were some incredible rainstorms in Italy, which I'd actually been fortunate enough to be on holiday in the Cinque Terre, which are the very beautiful villages on the coast of the Mediterranean in Liguria. And a couple of weeks later, I was back in New Zealand watching TV and seeing these beautiful villages with huge torrents streaming down their main streets. I think they'd had 200 or 300% of their previous record rainfall in the hills behind these towns. So it is shocking, and it's happening everywhere. But if you know, individual events make news, but unless you have that big picture being presented, you know, it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I'd like to see a big map that where these things just pop up and you could watch it on YouTube, you know. I mean, the African country of Niger just had, they had a crippling drought, and then they had an absolute deluge. One region, this was about a month ago, they got 6 months of rainfall in 24 hours. Who hears about it? Nobody. So I'd love to see that map. Well, on another topic, I've just been going through a study that shows humans tend to be pessimistic about other people, but quite optimistic about themselves and their own chances. And so we may worry about an unstable climate, but we think, well, it won't really affect me that much. And I'm wondering if that's one reason why developed countries refuse to even plan for things like heavy rainstorms or rising seas. Do you see any signs we're getting ready for what is coming?
I don't think we're getting ready for what I think is coming, because what I think is coming is, you know, going to be a real test for our civilization. There are signs, and it varies a lot from country to country and from state to state and from region to region. I mean, there are, you know, different countries are doing different things. In New Zealand, we have begun to take account of sea level rise for coastal development. Now, I might argue that the numbers that they're using do not account for the real potential sea level rise over the next 100 years. But, you know, processes are being put in place. And it's not hard for, you know, if you think there are damaging floods are going to be a more frequent occurrence, or heavy rainfall is going to be a more frequent occurrence, or that the intensity of that rainfall is going to be higher than it's been in the past, then when you put a new subdivision in, maybe you'll make your drainage a bit bigger. So I think those sorts of kind of under the radar, not very high profile stuff is happening. It isn't happening everywhere. You know, we're not all like those American legislators that try to stop mentions of sea level rise going into their planning documents. So, I mean, that's, at that sort of level, I think things are happening. But I don't think that there's, come back to this thing about the big picture. I don't think anyone's really taking account of the big picture and thinking, you know, well, maybe what we're doing is wrong. Maybe here in New Zealand, for instance, the government thinks that it's, you know, one of the routes to economic development for New Zealand is by mining more coal and by drilling for more oil. And in one sense, yeah, we've got some coal and we've probably got some oil. So, yes, we probably could make quite a lot of money, actually, because, you know, oil's running out and coal's not exactly falling out of the sky. So, yeah, maybe we could make a bit of money. But on the other hand, there's a huge liability in doing that, because if we put all of our money now into developing that coal and that oil, then at the point where the world realizes, and I mean the world by the international community, realizes that they are going to have to take this problem seriously, then suddenly what's being written into the books as an asset suddenly becomes a major liability. And you've screwed your economy by pushing it in one direction now because it seems sensible. And then the paradigm shift comes, and I mean, I've got to hope and pray that that paradigm shift happens sooner rather than later, and suddenly all of this stuff, which was economically wonderful, becomes economically stupid.
Well, I've got to introduce you to our Prime Minister, because we've got him pushing the tar sands like a salesman at a used car lot. This is Radio Eco Shock from the Waipara Valley of New Zealand. We're talking with Gareth Renouden, co-host of The Climate Show. Gareth, I've been a fan of that program. It's amazing the way you and radio broadcaster Glenn Williams managed to do both video and audio, occasionally with some computer graphics thrown in there. What's happening with The Climate Show at the moment?
Well, as you may have known, we've mentioned it a couple of times in the sort of last couple of shows. Glenn has made a move to the UK. So he and his partner have gone over to London, and they're setting up home in London. And I understand from Glenn's tweets recently that their sort of shipping container of their gear from Auckland has arrived in London. So I'm very much hoping Glenn's going to be setting up his own little broadcasting studio in his home in London, and The Climate Show will get underway again fairly soon. We're going to have a bit of technological experimentation, because what was working over the network of New Zealand and suddenly going to have to be thoroughly global. And if regular viewers or listeners to The Climate Show will know that the technology challenge of using Skype over sort of sometimes ropey internet connections can be quite large, but we're going to give it a go. It'll be Glenn having breakfast and me having dinner, and John Cook will all be doing something else. But The Climate Show will be coming back.
And where can people find your past programs?
There are two places. One is the Climate Show website. Just Google The Climate Show, and that will get you the Climate Show website. And the other is at Hot Topic, which is my blog in New Zealand, hot-topic.co.nz. And there's a Climate Show category in the just above the logo at the top of the blog there.
All right. Well, Gareth Renouden, you've just released your first science fiction book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Aviator. I nicked an idea from a famous old writer called Jonathan Swift, who listeners may have heard of, because he wrote a book called Gulliver's Travels. And I've been thinking for some years, that, you know, it's one thing for you and I, Alex, to talk about climate change and the impacts and what's happening and the news and this, everything else. And that informs a certain sort of person. It provides a certain context, information that people can use in their day-to-day lives. But there is another and equally powerful, probably perhaps even more powerful way of making people think about that issues, and that's by telling stories. And what I wanted to do is to tell a story about the world that we're heading for without, I didn't want to scare people, but I wanted people to realize that the settings that we're on are taking us to a place which is, yeah, pretty unreal, really. And so what I wanted to do is to create a world, which I've called the burning world, and I wanted to put into it a means of getting around that world to explore what climate change has done and what our policies and ideas and communities, that how they might be sort of coping in the future. One of the things that people often don't realize about Gulliver's Travels, they think that it's you know, a kid's book, because it's been retold for children over many, many hundreds of years. But in fact, when Swift wrote it, it was a satire of the sort of court and politics and ideas of the time. And so I wanted my book to be, you know, gently satirical, if you like, about some of the ways that we think about things. So my hero is called Lemuel, which is what Gulliver's Christian name was. And Lemmy and his girlfriend Kate basically fly around this climate-changed world, and they visit the new polar cities in the Canadian archipelago. They're called Lovelock and Bloom. And they cross a melting Greenland. They visit the Northern Lights, which are actually the methane fires north of Siberia. And then they go on and they meet communities. There's the rock god Evangelist. There's the last community of climate deniers. There's the libertarians in their big bubble. So, yeah, basically, I've been calling it a comedy adventure satire.
The ultimate climate road trip, perhaps.
Something like that, yes. And it's in its very early days at the moment. It's sort of creeping out. It's available on Amazon and Smashwords, and will be available on most of the major ebook retailers in the very near future. And I'm just putting together, actually, I stopped when you rang. I was putting together the print version, which will be available sometime in September. And, then I've got to start writing the book two. Yeah, everybody who's read it seems to want to know what happens next. So I've got a bounden duty, I suppose.
So keep your eye out for The Aviator. And I want to say, too, that from what I've seen, islands in the sea like the UK and New Zealand may be better protected from extreme climate change than the great continents or even Australia. I heard New Zealand agreed to take some climate refugees, namely people from low-lying reef countries in the South Pacific. Is that correct?
It's not. I mean, I think Al Gore said that we'd agreed to take lots of climate refugees from sinking Pacific islands. We actually have the relationship that we have with the Pacific islands is a bit more complex than that. I think there are some Pacific islands where the population of islanders in New Zealand is greater than that left on the original islands now anyway. But that's so far been mainly economic in terms of the migration. But yeah, I mean, I think as one of the richer countries in the region and one of the larger countries in the region, I think it's pretty inevitable that we're going to end up providing a refuge for those Pacific Islanders who find themselves threatened by rising sea levels. I will say that New Zealand is probably going to be a good place to ride out climate change, because we are surrounded by a big and relatively cool ocean, which will act as a kind of air conditioner for us. But, you know, I take that as a small compensation, because, you know, in reality, the rest of the world is going to get hammered, and we will not be immune down here. We've had some pretty weird weather too. I mean, we get months. This winter has had a couple of really sharp cold spells with amazing frosts for our valley, almost unheard of, certainly not measured in the last 20 or 30 years. And then we've had 3 weeks of extremely wet weather, and now it's the equivalent of the end of February down here, and I'm looking outside. The air temperature's about 15, 16 degrees Celsius. The lawn was mowed for the first time on Sunday, and that probably means once I've started, I have to continue. So it's almost as though we're almost feels like early summer out there. So you know, it's the variability is biting everywhere, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for people who are raising food, as you are. How did you become a journalist and a communicator?
Oh, long time ago. I left university and I sort of fell into a job in publishing and ended up being a writer and then a magazine editor and then a magazine publisher. And almost everything I've done, if I haven't been writing, I've usually felt that I ought to be. So, yeah, writing, I think, is one of the things that you talk to a lot of writers, so they just, you can't stop doing it. You have to find something to write about. And I was interested in climate change a long time ago. Actually, while I was at school and going to university, I can remember reading books about how the climate system worked. It's not what I studied at university, but I've always been interested in weather and climate. And I sort of followed the development of the issue in the late 80s and early 90s. In fact, in my wife and I were living in London in the early 90s. We bought a house in a suburb called Teddington, and I actually planted a peach tree because I thought that, in 15 or 20 years' time, the peaches would do really well, which is not something you'd often say in London. One day I'll go back to that house and see if that peach tree is producing peaches.
Gareth, we are running out of time. Is there something else you'd like to tell our listeners as we wrap up?
Well, I'd keep watching the north, really. Friends in the UK have asked me, how will we know when climate change is going to get really bad? And my answer has been pretty consistently since 2007, just watch what's happening in the Arctic, because that's where climate change is happening writ large. And what's happened up there this year just demonstrates that climate change is not a theoretical possibility for all of our futures. Climate change is real, and it's here, and it's happening now.
Well, give us a couple of your websites just to help people out.
Okay, so you can follow what I'm up to at hot-topic.co.nz, and The Climate Show is at theclimateshow.com. And if anyone wants to follow up on The Aviator, you can just search for The Aviator at Amazon, or it's on amazon.com and .uk and so on. And The Aviator has its own website, which is burningworldbooks at WordPress. So it should be easy to find.
From New Zealand, thanks so much, Gareth Renouten.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
There's no way to do anything but skim over some world-shattering news, along with developments in the alternative movement. And so, it's time for Tip of the Iceberg News. The macroeconomy is sinking. The United States is set for a leveraged buyout, Bain Capital style. That's where you raid a company, or a country, with a few million in campaign donations maybe, load up the victim with unrepayable debt, while paying out big-time fees that heads for a tax-free trip to the Cayman Islands. Get the details from one of the best pieces of American journalism in a generation, Matt Taibbi's article, Greed and Debt, The True Story of Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. It's in the online version of Rolling Stone magazine. In Europe, Spain is going down. So far, about 17% of all the money in Spanish banks has left the country. One bank has already been nationalized. The others bought billions in Spanish government debt with bailout money poured in by the European Union. Spain makes Greece look tiny in comparison. Spain's collapsed economy and real estate is a sinkhole, threatening to drag down the even larger magnificent Ponzi debt scheme of Italy. And then it's a sleigh ride all the way down for the European Union. China is holding a big garage sale and still can't get rid of its overstocked warehouses. People are being laid off there, my friends, and they're calling for another bailout. It seems their overseas customers are broke. In the U.S., helicopter Ben Bernanke has already offered bailout number three, billions more dollars. We don't know how much, out off the government printing presses and into the hidden accounts of bankers and hedge funds. You know it's bad when the bailouts come. Don't sit up late waiting for your check. Despite all that, I don't expect a big crash really soon. Remember, even after the $50 billion Ponzi fraud by Bernie Madoff was exposed and documented, it took another 8 years for the man to fall. See the documentary film Chasing Bernie Madoff with whistleblower Harry Markopoulos. You'll see how the system never works to protect you. You hear rumors about China, the coal plant a week meme, and big storms. When we come back, we'll go to Beijing with Greenpeace campaign leader Li Yan. That's followed by more Tip of the Iceberg news and a peek at upcoming programs. Stay tuned with Radio EcoShock.